Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Christine Williams.
You're listening to Fiber Talk, that twice-weekly podcast for people, in this case, who make the finest of art with needle and thread.
Yeah.
Yes. So back very quickly, probably the fastest turnaround we've had for a repeat guest, Gay-Ann Rogers. Hi, Gay-Ann.
Hi, Gary. Hi, Christine.
Welcome.
I'm happy to be back.
Thanks for joining us. And so we're having Gay-Ann back because we're going to do something that we have not done, at least to my recollection, we've not done, and that is to devote an entire show to talking about one design and what goes into it. And that's Gay-Ann's new design. Now, for all you people who are about to say, well, but I'm not going to stitch it and I'm not interested, yes, you are, because you want to hear what Gay-Ann, what goes into making a design, planning out the colors, all the decisions. You want to hear that those stories. So stick around for us. And also, I would highly recommend that you go to Gay-Ann's page, GayAnnRogers.com, or our page, WeTalkFiber.com. I probably should have suggested that first, but I didn't. Or if you're watching on FlossTube, I will put a picture of the design so that it is there in front of you the entire time so that you can visually refer to it. So you want to have that on your screen in some way as you listen, because it will really help you. And so, Gay-Ann, let's see. This is going up Sunday. And so when did we introduce the last queen?
The last queen comes on Friday. Well, it came on Friday, the 10th of August.
Okay.
And it will have been on my website for a couple of days by the time you post it.
Yes. So the last queen is the way you've been referring to it, this design,
right.
and that's because why?
Because it's the last portrait I'm stitching.
Okay.
I'm finished.
So before we go there, do you want to just give us a rundown of the previous queens, the roster,
yes,
if you will?
The roster of queens, the first one I did was Elizabeth I. I did it as a challenge to myself because I saw Elizabeth I in a magazine where the proportions were all off, but the claim to fame was that it was original stitches in the time of Elizabeth. So I turned it around and said to myself, I wonder what would happen if I made a portrait where there were no original stitches, there was nothing original at all about it, but I tried to preserve part of what goes into portraiture. The second one I did, then after I did Elizabeth I, everybody begged me to do Henry VIII. And I said, no, I, as a self-respecting woman, I will not have on my walls somebody who beheaded his wives. No. And
no.
So my husband suggested that I do Catherine the Great. So I did Catherine the Great. The third one I chose was Eleanor of Aquitaine. I was wanting to dabble in some medieval things. And then he chose Victoria. And he chose Victoria. Can I tell you why he chose Victoria? He chose Victoria in part for her relation to Elizabeth I.
Yes.
And he chose her. I said, but she's not a strong person. By that, I mean a strong ruler in the sense of the first three, who lived on the edge and lived dangerously. He said, oh, but she was strong because she, first of all, she didn't rule, but she reigned over the largest
empire?
The largest empire. Yes, the largest empire the world's ever known. And he said she had a lot of strength that you have to think of, in part because she had the institutional strength behind her. He thought she was the natural person. So I thought about it for a while and gave in, and Victoria was the fourth.
Okay. Talked into it by her husband.
What? Right.
So, okay, so the last queen is Queen Victoria. But then, you know, a lot of the pictures, at least people who don't follow these things as closely as I do, of Queen Victoria are when she's an older lady. But you chose to do her as a bride.
I did. I chose to do her as a bride because I had known, I collected Honiton lace, which is an English bobbin lace, for a number of years. And I thought, oh, her veil and her dress are all Honiton. And I thought, I wonder if there's a way that I could stitch some of the patterns in needlepoint, but make them reflect the Honiton. And that was the challenge. I mean, in the end, that wasn't, that was just one of the challenges. But her face, I didn't know I'd get, I didn't know whether I could get beyond her face or not. I didn't know whether I could make her look a little like Victoria, whether I could make her pretty enough. I didn't know any of those things. So I just started. And then I had a bunch of other challenges. I think we'll talk about them as we go.
Yeah, the face, well, I've said this before, and I will say it many, many times from now on. The way you do faces with needlepoint, it just boggles my mind. And
oh,
here,
thank you.
I mean, here's just another one. You make them look like humans instead of, you know, dorky is the only word I've ever come up with to describe faces I typically see in needlepoint or in a lot of stitching, but you really put a life to them. And you were telling me the other day, what do you have, 32 stitches across to work with?
Whether it's 30 or 34, I don't know. I always say it's 32. It could be that queen. It could be Victoria. It could have been one of the other queens. Mine is framed, and I just need to sit down and count it. I haven't, but it's somewhere around 30-something stitches across. So it just isn't very much room. Part of the reason I think that so many needlepoint faces are I think they're just downright ugly. My students used to say they're horrible. There's not room. There just isn't room. So that if you're doing a traditional tent stitch, say Berlin work, you put one stitch in for the eye, one stitch in for the other eye, one stitch for the nose, and two stitches for the mouth, and you're done. And what's that going to look like? There isn't room for any subtlety at all. And if you do cheeks, I don't know how many you've looked at, but if you do cheeks, this is the thing that bugs me the most. If you do cheeks, you do them in bright pink in contrast.
And that doesn't work. So
circles, circles.
I will interject with a small admission that so you know how you can set up this completely, not completely, but somewhat unrelated. You can set up alerts on eBay for, you know, items that you're interested in buying, right? So
right.
If I'm interested in buying a whatever it is, an embroidery hoop, I'll set up an alert for embroidery hoops, and whenever one comes up, it will send me an email.
Yeah.
I have an alert set up for needlepoint kits for old ones, because that's really the only ones that come up are these old ones. And it is a delight on the weekend sometimes to just see some of the old needlepoint kits that come up, because they're actually hilarious because of exactly that. They were just so hard to do, and they were, you know, it's not like the painted canvases of now where people are taking time to really try to recreate something and make it true to life or do, you know, any sort of fine work. These were the old sort of the things of my childhood when I thought of needlepoint. That, you know, these it's tigers and eagles and things that are, you know, valuable in some way. But then when you get to the faces, like the, sometimes there'll be small children, things like that. And they're frightening, to be quite honest.
There just isn't enough room to do it. If you've got, take a Berlin work pattern, sometimes for a child's face will be 5 stitches wide, 1 stitch for the side of the face, 1 stitch for the eye, 1 stitch between the eyes, 1 stitch the eye, and 1 stitch the other side of the face, and you're finished. That's it.
So how do you make it work?
I first of all try hard to kick out everything that I don't think is necessary. So that I watched a bunch of videos at some point on YouTube, I don't know, a few years ago, and on how to draw faces. And what I found was I wanted to stop them halfway through and say, okay, that's enough. But the people who were drawing them got hung up on making them look photographically real. And I wanted to stop halfway through. So I then watched it again and thought, why is it that I want to stop halfway through? And I found out, because you don't need to say all that much. So I like to do, I mean, I think, Gary, you and I talked about making thread recommendations. My followers, by and large, will whine at me about using floss. They want to use only silk. I use a combination of floss and silk because I think the floss has a harder twist to it. I think it makes better flesh. It's cleaner flesh. So I tent stitch basically the face, and then I overstitch it with the colors, sometimes silk, sometimes floss, depending on whether you want it to be slightly narrow or slightly plump. And I carve out, I may put 4 stitches for an eyeball and a 2 stitches white on one side, 2 stitches on the other. And then I depend on the overstitching to accomplish the face.
Hmm.
And a nose, I find stitching a nose is just terrible. So I overstitch a nose. I put the nostril in and overstitch the nose so that it disappears. That's the fastest way to make people worried about faces.
So when we look at this face, there's effectively 2 layers working here.
Probably more like 3.
Oh, okay.
Ah.
Everything on that queen, the canvas is not that large, but it's all a matter of layering. I began doing this, I think last time that we had a conversation, I said that Cezanne had had a huge impact on me. Without those lessons that I felt I took from him, I mean, I didn't, but I felt like I did. If I hadn't been on that study program, I could have never done this. It taught me, can we skip for a minute to the background because it's the easiest one to understand?
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
In Victoria, one of my major problems was she's a brunette wearing a white dress. She had to be on white canvas, right? Because
yep.
There's no way to cover up a colored canvas with white thread entirely. So she had to be on white canvas, and she's got dark brown hair. So do you know what? If you stitch her dress on white canvas, guess what happens? She looks like a lollipop because all you see is the dark hair.
Uh-huh.
So the only way to bail out of that is to find a background color that's halfway between, or approximately halfway between, the darkness of the hair and the whiteness of the dress. And then it mediates the dress, it mediates the hair. So that backgrounds, people just use all sorts of things for backgrounds. To me, they are just, well, in this piece in particular, it was just totally crucial. So when I have a habit of liking to tent stitch all of the background before I start applying the top layer. And lots of people say, why don't you just paint it, or why don't you just use 3-ply instead of 1-ply? Because then the background rises up and overpowers the figure. If you tent stitch it all in the color you're going to use, and then you go back over it, you could find you can use 1-ply and it blends together, and yet it recedes.
Mm-hmm.
So with this particular piece, I thought, am I going to get this right? And it's 15 hours worth of basket weave, and if I don't get it right, all that ripping. What I found, actually, it wasn't on this queen, it was on an earlier one. Say I got the background too dark, I could mediate it a little bit by changing the value of the color on top, or mm-hmm. vice versa. If it were too light, I could use a slightly darker. You can't use a lot darker, but you can use a slightly darker. In this particular piece, the background was slightly dull looking when I got the tent stitch in. I used the same color, and I used the same color on the top, and it lightened it up a bit. And then I applied the white dots with the blue in the center, and that did it. Then if you look at the piece, you can see that the brown hair shows as brown hair, and the dress shows as white, but they're equal in some ways because the background color mediates between them.
Yeah, and as you're talking, I'm sitting here and I'm squinting at it to change the
right.
view, and I can see how if I mentally make that background white, what you mean about the hair, it just screams
at
you.
That's all you'll see.
Yeah.
So the background, choosing a background for a piece, it doesn't matter about this one. It's been the same case with all the queens. It's the same case every time I stitch an entire background. It is so important because if you made this stitch, which is an upright stitch, if you made it to cover that white, you would have to make it in 3 or 4-ply. Do you know how thick that is in comparison to the design, which is stitched in 1-ply?
Mm-hmm.
It would just overpower it. So this way lets me sort of cheat.
Hmm.
And it's a technique that I started doing this, as I said, a long time ago when I was doing that Cezanne. I was actually doing it differently. It was really hard. I took over dyed and stitched like a painter paints a base, and then I stitched on top of it to get the highlights, so I was changing colors all the time. In the background layer, if you use an over dyed, you have to predict where you want the over dyed to be darkest and lightest, and where you want the most contrast. You have to figure that out before you start applying the top layers. And in the case of my Cezanne landscape, it was, I think, 3 or 4 layers on top of it.
And then that's well and good if you're going to do it, but then if you're going to try to instruct someone else how to replicate that, that's almost impossible to do.
And somebody has to be sensitive to what happens to colors. They have to look at the skein and say, okay, it's this way in the skein, it's going to look very different on the piece. And let me give you the best example ever. Take a skein of let's say silk. Take one ply and stitch it, or two ply and stitch it on 18 mesh, which most people do. And you will find it changes color if you're using basket weave, because the shadow falls in the beginning of the stitch, shadow falls in the end of the stitch. And so it automatically becomes darker and duller. That's why experimenting is really a necessity, I hate to tell you. Mm. I mean, it's one of many reasons. Now, the same stitch done in Scotch stitch is going to look like an entirely different color, but it's still not going to look like the skein, because it still has that fall off where the thread goes into the canvas and comes out of it and goes up through the canvas and back down through the canvas. There's always going to be a slight, faint shadow that's going to gray the color out. See if you don't try it, and see if you don't think I'm right.
No, that makes perfect sense. I think that you don't pay that much attention to it. And then I wonder, though, that's a good point, though, because oftentimes I'll take a piece that I'm working on, and we work on things horizontally, right, pretty much. But then most of the time when you think about how you're going to hang a piece, you'll hang it vertically, and the light is going to fall on it completely differently.
You should work on it vertically.
Right.
So you get the color set up. Mm-hmm. I think that this is the easiest thing in a four-way design. When I write the directions for a four-way design, I write the first corner as the bottom left corner, so that you're working first with say it's a square piece. So you're working from the center down, you're holding it in the direction you'll hang it.
Right.
Then you get it all worked out. Then you can flip it upside down and work on it with no consequences, because you already know what it's going to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it makes a big difference.
It does.
Especially with things that are reflective, because they're going to reflect on one side of the thread, like you said, and then depending on the twist, it's going to reflect differently.
And also, if you ever take a piece and stand in front of a window and turn it so that it goes from 180 degrees with the light shining directly on it, go to 90 degrees perpendicular to the window and watch what happens.
Yeah, it's totally different.
Right. All of that enters into choices and why you have to pay attention to what's happening on the canvas. Just zoning out is not going, it just doesn't work. No matter how much somebody tells you, oh, just do this. You've got to keep a hawk's eye on it, at least in the setup. That's back to that, the enemy is the better is the enemy of the good.
Right.
I like that.
It's a really insidious thing, because it sits on your shoulders and you think, you know, I just did this. All right. Can I make it better? If I did this, would it make it better? Would it make it worse? Okay, I'm going to rip it out and try it. Usually I set it up 2 or 3 times and rip the ones I don't like when I'm working on the canvas, or I work on a doodle to see what happens. But even a doodle, it's a little patch, changes when it gets to be a big area.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is this, Gary, is this what you wanted me to do?
Yes. I'm learning. So can we safely say that people, particularly painted canvases, that people don't pay enough attention to the background?
In my humble opinion, that is true of whether it's counted. Any time that you're making up your own background stitch, you have to pay real attention to it. I had such a wonderful example, and I wanted to use it in the worst way, but I wasn't rude to do, so I didn't, but I bought it and kept it for myself as a reminder. The woman had stitched a crown. It was a very pretty, slender, silver crown, and she'd painted on the canvas. when she came to the background. Now, this is a slender, maybe a stitch, two-stitch wide in parts of constructing the silver. She'd used a metallic thread, and the crown looked beautiful. When it came to the background, guess what she did? She took the most complex stitch with the, I don't know how many colors she had, maybe five or six, and she had done a really chunky stitch so that when you looked at the final product, what it did was it went, hello, background, here you are. What happened to the crown? So that if you want, it all comes back to a basic lesson. And what is it that you want to show? What do you want? What's your focal point? And then you build around the focal point. So if you take, in a portrait, that was really easy to decide. The focal point of a portrait is always the face. So you do what you can to enhance the face. And if something does what I call climbing on top of it, instead of receding and supporting it, you don't want the secondary or the tertiary point to be the strongest. You want it to help and support the focal point.
Those are the things I find, for me personally, the easiest way for me to do those things is to walk away and to come back to it, because I tend to get sort of myopic about it, and you become focused on what you're doing.
And then you forget. Need
to, yeah, you forget.
You forget the forest. All you see are the trees.
Right. So, and then you need to walk away and see it another way, or turn it upside down, or do something like that so that you can't look at it as it, what it is, and so that you can just see color and shape, and then you can start seeing it again differently. You know, just anything you can to make it look different so that you can see it new.
There, I have two suggestions for this, which helped me. One of them is pick a place where the lighting is nice and pound a nail into the wall and then hang it up there for a couple of days. This isn't original to me. It's an art school suggestion. Hang the piece up on the wall and walk by it. Walk by it from this angle, that angle, whatever. And don't do it all at once. Leave it there for a couple of days and just keep walking by it. And when you walk by it, look at it, and it will bring a different vision to it. And the second thing is one of the biggest helps is Xerox a piece in black and white.
Yes, yes. I forgot then about that one.
Then you deal with the grayscale.
Well, that's the photographer trick there. If you can do good black and white photography, color's nothing.
Right, there you are.
Yeah, because that means you understand the light. Yeah, because good black and white photography is extremely difficult to do well.
Very.
Yeah. Yes, because you have to understand light. Yep.
And the same thing is true with this. It just translates its color, and it just translates into the same thing. That's the problem. That's why I wrote about red. Red is like black. They both just hog they just come out as so dark in the grayscale. That's the problem with red. So it's what shows up. It dominates. As long as you use a lot of red, it's fine. But when you get a little amount of red on a white dress, it's a problem.
Okay, this is real dumb guy, naive question here. Mm-hmm. But based on that discussion, when I look at this Queen Victoria, you have a really powerful element in terms of size and detail in the veil, yet it doesn't dominate the image. Help me understand that.
Okay, doing a wedding dress, doing white work, I mean, I like doing white work. And that was one of the reasons why I liked the idea of doing a bride, was the honiton, the white work bit, the pulled thread, some of it which doesn't show in a picture. You have a large, but always the face has to matter. Everything else in a portrait has to stand behind the face. It cannot take attention. So that if you look at paintings, if you spend some time looking at paintings of portraits by good painters, you'll find sometimes there's almost a halo effect where they've lightened the area around the face and then darkened it towards the edge of the canvas. Mm-hmm. And that, you can't do that in needlepoint. It's just, I tried it and it doesn't work. But what you've got to do is say, okay, what's the second point? So, I mean, I've got Victoria here. I hope that if the veil's got so complex that it sat on top of her face, ditto the orange blossoms, the wreath of orange blossoms, and you didn't see her eyes, you'd miss the whole point. You've got to see her eyes, then you see a mask, her whole face, and then you watch the veil supports her, or at least I hope it does. The hairline supports her. Notice I lightened it slightly around. It was dark around her face, and then I took a light and went over it so that it raises it up a bit.
Yep.
That's all got to be, it reads as, it was about, I thought that was, I think brunette always a challenge in needlepoint. And her eyes were, and her eyes are lighter. I tried to do them in the same browns as the hair, and it made them too dark. Then you look like somebody, do you know, with those, the eyeshadow that makes you look like a raccoon kind of, and I didn't want her to look like a raccoon. So I made it thinner around the dark, thinner around her face, and then notice that it changes to a light and then a middle brown. And then it goes into the dark brown again. And you can never do it realistically. I can't see the reason to do it realistically. What you want to do is give an impression of it so that it reads as a brunette hair.
Right.
So the same for the veil. It's got enough darkness in it. I learned early, well, I knew this from painting a bit when I was young, is that you need to create a shadow for white. Do you know the shadow for the good quality shadow for red is what? The opposite on the color wheel, right? Green. Not black, not gray, green. What's the shadow white? What's the opposite? It's all colors. So you can use almost anything you want. In my case, I like to use blue to blue green and a little bit of a grayed out color. I don't always use, and on Victoria, I used blue-green, a really grayed out blue-green. And that brings, it's interesting how it works, because if you had the chart in front of you, you'd see that I've gone down all those white lines with a couple grays, blue-greens. It makes the white rise up. You can see that on the nubs of the, I don't know if it shows in the picture enough.
Yeah, no, it does. This is,
see, you don't see the blue-green. All you see is that the white looks whiter.
Yeah.
That's the idea of a shadow, I think. That was how I treated it. So I tried to make it so that it came forward. I had hoped that the pulled thread in it would show more, the transparency, but it didn't. So perhaps if I were to do it over again, I don't know whether I would or not, put some of her brown hair in a lighter brown through the part of the veil to make it look transparent. But, you know, I'm happy with it the way it is.
Yeah, I don't know. That would be interesting to see that.
Might make it look messy. That's what I wondered.
Yeah.
You might overcomplicate it.
Right. So the first rule in doing these is if you can, and I find people violate this in needlepoint all the time. The first rule is figure out, I could do it this way, this way, this way, this way. As a rule of thumb, start with the simplest way, not the hardest. And if the simplest doesn't work, go one level up in difficulty. Then, so that most of the times for me that I feel I've been successful, it's been with something tried, true, and simple. Simplest stitches. Simplest threads. It took a long time to come to that.
Yeah, yeah. Now, it's also interesting to me in that you have the orange blossoms in the hair and then also her bouquet. You know, two more elements that have a chance to really get in the way of the vision, and they don't.
Partly, you know, in this case, I think it was scale.
Okay.
Scale is hugely important. I find her bouquet interesting because in the painting, I don't know whether this is true or not. She notice she's not carrying, it's pinned to the front of her. And it was in the painting also. I think you have access to it. If you go and look at my sources, you'll see the real painting. And I turned her more forward facing slightly than the painter painted her. So that you can't really see. But I think it's pinned to her. I don't know whether it was that in fact or he just did that, put it there. I don't know. I don't have any idea.
Yeah.
But the orange blossoms, I think what helps them, sparse and scale. So again, the white, notice the green mediates with the white, and the white mediates with the green. If it were all green, it would be too strong. If it were all white, it wouldn't work. It would be too much of a clump. In the same way that I think in the veil, the blue-green breaks it up.
Yeah, now that,
I don't know. I'm just guessing.
Well, but I find this fascinating about how you create shadow in that veil, because I had not given that any thought other than in the picture, there is very definite visual texture throughout, and it as I study it more, it clearly is a lot of it because of the shadowing.
The shadowing, people say was shading. They take on shading. I think shading and needlepoint's hard. But with this, you have to be very careful of the color, very careful of the weight of the thread. And then where I think I did it the best, see the veil on the left and see the veil on the right, and then where it meets her dress.
Mm-hmm.
It took me a couple times to do that. At first I did it, it was too thin, so I added to it. Then I got it to be too much, so I ripped it out. And finally I got it to the point where it was enough to make the dress recede, but not so much that the dress looked gray.
Yeah.
Well, hard to do.
Oh, yeah, but there's clearly a layer of veil over the dress.
Right. And it's not, in this case, there isn't.
Hmm.
It's just all the shadow. Uh-huh. But the shadow, notice the shadow is really, really, really simple. I use two colors to do it. As I remember, I haven't got my list in front of me. Usually I have two colors, one that's very pale and one that's not quite so pale. And then I try and juggle them. And I get it wrong all the time. I cut it out, try it again, and go get more thread. This is what I mean about trial and error. It's back to the same old thing, which unfortunately I learned early in my married life, that better is the enemy of the good, and trying to get to wonderful. Wonderful doesn't happen very often.
But when it does, it's so special.
When it does, it's happened to me maybe only once or twice, where I thought, oh, I took the last stitch. Thank you for coming into my life. But it's so much work. So, and a lot of people, I've had people in classes, I've said, why don't you rip that? It's just three rows. I don't want to rip it. I say, oh, you wuss. I just ripped out half of it. But that's me. It's my own. You know, I think for each one of us, there has to be a judgment about what fascinates you, what you want to do with it, where you're going with it, and what you expect out of it. Once you decide that, I think to some extent, you determine how much you want to rip. I don't know that this is worthwhile discussion.
Well, no, it is, and I'm really glad to hear you say that, because now when I was doing photography at a ridiculous level, I really cut back anymore. But I have thousands and thousands of photos, you know, macro photography, close up, a lot of flowers, and I have one image out of thousands, maybe two, where I can hold up and say, bingo.
There you have it.
There's no flaw here. This is exactly what I saw. It's what I wanted. I executed it perfectly. And all the others, there's always something. And for you to say, you know, better is
The better is the enemy of the good. I'm sorry to do that to you, because you'll never, ever, ever think of, you'll always think from now on, am I doing this? It's okay. But what could I do to make it better?
Yep.
If you can get past that and you don't think about that the way I do with almost every stitch I take, then you go, okay, that's all right. All right. Why would you put all this time and effort into all right if you thought you could make it better?
Yeah.
So for nothing, if nothing else, it's an educational thing.
Yeah.
So, but that's me. That's not the bulk of stitchers. And with this, people say, I thought this was with these portraits of mine. I get two reactions to them. One is people are so afraid of them, they refuse to stitch them. They're amongst the easiest things I've ever made to stitch. I did all the work. All you have to do is count over chart. Now, that's not always true in what I do, but it isn't true. It is true. These are just, stop and look at Victoria for a minute. Her whole face is basket weave with a little overstitching. Her hair is stem stitch. You probably learned stem stitch when you were 6 years old if you embroidered at the feet of your grandmother or somebody. There's an upright stitch in the background. There's a running stitch, more tent stitch, some overstitching. The hardest thing in the whole thing is the ribbon embroidery. And how hard is a straight stitch and ribbon embroidery? And a French knot. And so I'm going to offer this that I learned when I actually was an embroidery student. To make a French knot, if you want it to be clean, only ever once around the needle. You want a thin French knot, go once around the needle with a thin thread. Medium, once around the needle with a medium. large once around the needle with with thick thread. Never twice. And all the books say twice. I mean, if you see them, they say once around,
oh,
once around.
Oh, man. Oh, no. I always do twice. Oh.
No, never.
I've never done twice.
All right, now you're welcome to do twice if you want a sloppy French knot, and there are times when you do.
Well, but and see, now that's the trouble is I don't always get the French knot I want, and I've never really it's a frustration for me. It's never consistently clean.
So see if you think I'm right. Well, I mean, it's not my idea. I learned it in school. Only ever once. My own English embroidery teacher used to say that. You want sloppy French knots? Go two or three times around. Only ever once.
I've never done it more than one time unless I, yeah, that's so weird. So I was taught by my grandmother who was English. That's why.
Yes, that's probably. So what is the hardest thing on this? A French knot. How hard is a French knot? Not that hard. But it wires people. They just, I don't know what they think is going to happen to them. That's one of the reasons I said this is the end of it. Because they just get to, I don't know, the face makes them so uptight. Some of them won't start. Some of them have never started. I said, it's just basket weave.
Yeah.
And it tells you, I haven't left anything to your imagination. I've graphed it all. But that it just gets people wired, and that's okay. I try hard with my bag of tricks to get them to start. Once they get the face done, then they get nervous about the rest of it because they don't want to ruin the face.
Is that what you always suggest? The starting point is always, the face.
Always.
Okay.
Face is the focal point. You can if you start on the other elements. If you leave the face and start with the other elements, what can you react off to see whether it's working or not? And mm-hmm. I will say this, the stitches are very easy. You have to pay attention to your tension. So if you're doing the hair, how can you do the hair without the face underneath to see how large is the brow, whether it's falling in the right place, all that. You have a little latitude, not a lot, but a little latitude. And tension is the bugaboo of all in needlework. And it has the value of being on Congress cloth. And Congress cloth does hide a multitude of sins now and again. You just can't see well enough to see the mistake.
Amen. I sit here with my Congress cloth.
And I wonder, I have a lot of people who stitch my projects. And they stitch them a lot. They stitch them really well. But no, who can among us can make it perfect? You can't.
Yeah.
It's not part of the human condition to be perfect. And would you really want it to be anyway? Don't you like seeing that it's sometimes just an effort of your hand?
No.
No?
No. It's got, no.
Oh, I do.
That's what drives me nuts. It's got to be just right.
Do you want it to be machine-made looking?
No.
No. What do you want it to be?
I want it to be spot on. Perfect tension across the board.
Gary and I are different. I'd rather be a little freewheeling and try something new. But that's why we work so well together, because we pull at completely opposite ends of the tug of war rope.
I also think, Gary, that your attitude is a bit male.
Well,
but I mean, I've known a lot of men stitchers, and they are very, as a rule, they are very, 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 very precise, and which is nice.
You know what's funny, though? So in our careers, though, if you flip it, Gary is in a more creative field, and I am in more science and engineering field. So in our professions, my job is all about precision and engineering and metrics and all of those things. And Gary is all about words and fluid and creativity. And then we go home and we relax by doing the opposite thing.
But I would say, I would guess that both of you have to bring some precision to your jobs and also a bit of creativity to your jobs.
Oh, there's, in writing and editing, there's tremendous amount of
and that it always isn't constant. Sometimes it's more precise. Sometimes it's more creative. Sometimes it's both. That's
true.
Hard.
No, sure. With every magazine, there's constant back and forth about whether to phrase it this way or that. And at some point, you just have to say, good enough, we got to get the issue to the printer. But,
And finally, I say about these pieces of mine, I say, you know, I've had you long enough. I'm tired of you. We're finishing you. Bye.
Yep. You do have to get to that point, don't you?
You do. Yeah. And besides that, you know, you're never going to do it perfectly. There's always next time you can try to be more perfect. I think I said this the last time, too. This is an ongoing process. It doesn't stop. I don't stop because I finished this. I go on and bring the lessons from this into the next one and the lessons from the next one into the one after that. And it seems like there's a freedom in that.
Yeah.
And I bet you do the same with your magazines. You think, you know, I don't like the way I did that the last time.
I'm gonna try
it this way this time. And it's just, I think it's just part of the ongoing process. And Christine, I would guess, even though engineering is very precise and all that, there's still some, I wonder what would happen if I did it this way.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
That's a creative process.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm sounding terribly biased and prejudiced, but...
No.
I've been doing this a long time, too long.
I think that the people that do exceptionally well at each of the different ends of the spectrum have to have a blend of each, right? So a very, very good engineer is not going to be an exceptional engineer unless he has some creativity, right? And a good artist is never going to be an exceptional artist unless they have some technical discipline.
Do you know, my father was an engineer. And he had a, you know, people used to say to me, how come I took to the computer at my advanced age? And my husband always says it was the part, I'm my father's daughter, except I can't do math and science. It came out of the computer. But I saw that that was his best benefit. Was he was really creative for what he did. He just imagined. It got him in trouble at times, but he did it.
Mm-hmm.
People used to say to me, where did you get this? And I said, if I told you that my father went to Caltech, would you understand? It's the easiest way to describe it.
Can't be helped, yeah.
Right. But I think there is, and I think they're not. I think all of these things of imagining something and watching it come to fruition, whether it be Christine, the engineering in you, or Gary, the writer, magazine person in you, it's not really very far apart.
Yeah, probably not. Talk about the necklace and the earrings and, you know, the beadwork and the chunks of glass and making them stand out with the shadow work and without them dominating the piece.
That's a problem sometimes. The problem of the beads is that they stand up off the canvas too high. And there's no way to compensate for that. So what you do is I look for pearls that have a flat backside on them. So it rests again. I look for flat gems. And I like these. I was lucky in her. It cost me a fortune, but I was lucky. I found the diamonds in her necklace are Montes. They're 1920s to 50s. Little glass faceted things that are stuck in metal. And they used them in costumes. And they're in varying degrees of quality. And I ran across some that were just so beautiful quality. So I bought them all and I saved them. I had little ones and I had medium sized ones. And I saved them when it came to her. I thought, this is the one to do it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's coloring. In this case, if I did it all Montes, which didn't call for, which are the glass ones, it would have been too strong. So you can, again, you know how you mediate with the colors? You can mediate with seed beads in the same way. If you are careful about the color seed beads you use, and in the size, again, it's all about scale and color. And the seed beads, I use some tiny ones and some medium-sized ones. And I didn't make it. I had this trouble with Catherine the Great, too. My husband's comment about my Catherine was that her gems were too small. He said, you know, she would have never been caught dead in those. And if you look at the actual portrait of Victoria, they're much larger. But I think if you make them too large, then it begins looking crafty and it does exactly what you said, Gary, detracts. So I always reduced the size of them a bit. even though most of these people have, I mean, particularly the Russians. I did a, this is a secret, I did the Imperial State British Crown for my full sale. And in it, it has the Cullinan diamond, which is the largest diamond that I think they've ever, gem quality diamond that the world's ever found. And it's, they split it into two. And the smaller half is in the British Imperial State Crown, and the larger is in the orb or the scepter. I can't remember which. Well, do you know, it's 300 and some carats. Mm. So imagine if I put in scale a 300 and some carat on the crown. It would look ridiculous.
Yeah.
So I just had a little artistic. I found some big, but I mean, it's not as big. And these are the same. These on the real portrait, these are much, much larger. But I reduced the size, and particularly in the earring, because I thought the scale just, I get to do that. If people don't like it, they can search up the beads and do it bigger. But I feel it's more in scale. It's more in my vision of how it looks. And the parting thing about these queens that I'm afraid I'll forget to say is they are not intended to be historical pieces. They're fantasies. So you can make them whatever you want.
Yeah.
That's the best part of them. I got to, I got to make her how I wanted her to look. I had, I mean, I wanted her to be a commercially okay project, but within the scale, I got to do what I wanted to do. And I say to people, you know, if you see her dressed in a bright blue dress, dress her. It's your fantasy. It's nobody else's, and it's not historic. There's nothing historical about it, except the origin of the idea.
Yeah.
But isn't it neat that we get to do this in our time? We get to take these and translate them into what their fantasies for our time.
Right. Right. I love the story you were telling me about. Is it the Star of the Garter and the red?
Yes.
The struggle you had with the red in that?
God. Yes. The red, note, I rarely use black. I almost always use charcoal. There's a black, and I don't remember what the number of it. I tend to use soie d'Alger all the time. I like the color range. I like the feel of it. I like the size of it. I also am a great floss user. For face and hair, I almost always use floss. I like how it acts better. I like the silk for clothes. So in soie d'Alger, I had a red. Well, let me go back to the black for a minute. Black is so harsh, and if you reduce it to charcoal, it looks in the hank like it's charcoal. But remember that shadow I was talking about?
Mm-hmm.
3226 is the number of charcoal that I like, and it looks really charcoaly in the whole hank. But when you get stitching with it, that shadow effect falling on the ends of the stitches converts it so it looks black. I mean, if you think about it, it doesn't, but it's dark enough. Otherwise, it just overpowers everything. Red's the same way. Red's a horrible color. To do this, I thought it was a nightmare, but it had to have some red. The red got diluted by the gray, which was nice. I used a real bright red on the star where there's just a cross. On the garter, what they call the garter collar, it was worse. It just got so red. So I went back to the needlepoint store and looked at all the reds and found the best red. Red is red, but it wasn't. Most, by the time you dilute the color of red, usually a coral, pink, orange, this red is red. I mean, that you could read it as red, I should say. And it wasn't. It was much lighter. It was much desaturated. Mm. You know, it took some of the color out of it, some of the intensity of the color.
Mm-hmm.
And I love finding it. I bought a whole lot of it because I just liked it. It's terrible.
What was the biggest challenge? What was the biggest challenge in this piece?
Oh, her face.
Yeah.
By far. The next biggest challenge was the background color. The mediating between, if you ask, you're a photographer. You know in wedding what people say about wedding photographers?
Yeah.
How they hate white dresses?
Yep.
Because they're so hard against backgrounds.
Yep.
Well, so you get a brunette with a white dress. What are you going to do?
Yep. Oh,
and
yeah.
This was a problem. I used, now that I'm sitting here looking at her and thinking, I used a lot of that blue-gray shadow stuff, and that helped it. It helped delineate it. But the white's a problem, and next to the brown, I lightened the brown in certain places where I thought there should be highlights. I darkened the veil, and I, by hook and by crook, got to the right background. As I look at, you know, isn't it funny? I don't know whether you two do this or not. When you look at something you've stitched, you don't tend to see it. You see where the trouble spots were.
Right.
And you think, right, I got that one done. That's okay. Good. Move on. And the easy parts you just don't see.
Yep. Oh, that's true. Yeah. That's true.
Yeah.
So you have to have somebody else look at it.
Yeah, that's one. I think that's one of the frustrations of any of this kind of stuff is it. If you're the creator of the piece, it's so hard to look past the trouble spots. And
do you know, I learned in writing something, and I think it's true in this too, which is if you write, you know, if you write a page or something, first of all, Jim, my husband, always says, do you know, good writing versus bad writing, number of drafts. He said that as long as I remember.
Yep.
If you write a first draft and set it aside for a few days, you bring fresh eyes back to it. Same's true of this.
Yeah.
If you just muscle through, I don't think you're doing yourself a favor. Let it lie fallow for a while and let and think about it. And above all, if you ask me one last question, ask me what one recommendation I would make to get into that better. And I would say number of colors that you have in front of you that you can choose from and keep choosing. Don't start with one. Start with 3, 6, 7. Because the one that you end up using is often the biggest surprise.
Hmm.
Depends on what's next to it. So there are two color rules that the rest of them I throw out the window, but these two I live by. Color changes according to the amount you use. So color used in the red on Victoria, that color is little. Imagine if it had been big, how much redder it would have looked.
Mm-hmm.
And color changes according to what it's next to. Have you ever had that sensation? You had a blue green and you put it down and it turned green because of what it was next to.
Mm-hmm.
So amount of a thread and what it's next to, color of the thread and what it's next, amount and what it's next to, it's going to change, and it's not predictable. And that's what I think the impressionists knew. That's why you see so many of their paintings painted over and over and over again. Effect of light on the piece, where you are, all those things. It's just not a fixed entity. It changes.
Yeah. So the piece is always different depending on where and how you look at it.
Right. And that's part of its charm.
Talking to people like you always, I just, how clueless I am about color. And I'm sure it's a function of doing a lot of designs and having failures and knowing that these colors are not going to work in this situation. Trial and error, I'm sure, is a lot of that. But
Also just about the time that you start thinking that a color's not going to work, it will be the only color in that particular situation that does work. I think we're all just beginners. I don't think we ever get to be anything else. I just think it's so totally elusive. But you know what? That's its charm. If you could automatically just have it be wonderful, I think you'd lose interest. I think it's a challenge.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's true. I mean, to me, that's why I enjoy this stuff is, you know, this one got finished, but boy, there's another level with this, and like the piece I'm working on right now, there's a whole series of Byzantine stitch that's three strands of thread works. And, you know, I spent a lot of time laying those strands, but as I work back over adding in stitches in between and I see what I stitched, I just, I should really tear this out and do it again. Because I really am not happy with it. But then I remind myself I'm looking at it through a magnifier from 3 inches away.
Right.
And I need to back off. But, there's always that level. Yeah.
Let me make one recommendation. Try reducing from 3 to 2 and watch what happens.
Okay.
And if it looks
too
small. But, Gayanne,
I followed the instructions.
Well. Fair enough. Now, you know something, that's another thing. Just because I worked it in one doesn't mean you can. You might have to work it in two.
Yeah.
But try reducing sometimes. If you've got a two-part or three-part stitch you're using, don't, and the instructions tell you to use three-ply of something, don't. Use two-ply once, and if it looks too sparse, use four-ply in the next. See what happens. Hmm. Or three-ply. Monkey around with the actual, on a doodle. Monkey around before you start. Look at the stitch, try it. Monkey around with it and see what you could reduce.
See, and this is the, you know, this is the thing, and it frustrates me to no end, because I always, when I do these things, I fall into the trap, and I trap not as a negative thing, but of following the directions exactly and mindlessly. And
that's, it's easier. It's easier.
Right.
Yeah, it is.
But then when we talk
to, I've gone to all this work doing it. I must know. You know what?
Yes.
Bottom line, I don't. I don't have a clue. And I don't have a clue most of the time what it's going to look like when I start it. How much in the world am I going to have a clue how it looks when you start it?
Yeah.
So part of the burden falls back on you.
No, that's what I'm feeling, is with everything that I stitch, I should stop and say exactly that. If this is what's called for, is one more better, is one less better, let me go to the side and see how it looks.
Right.
And then make a decision.
And then change the color too, because, you know, value matters a lot. So that if you're using more, a darker value is going to look still darker. Fewer, it's going to, the same value is going to look lighter. That's why I don't think, you know what, it's hopeless. Our conversation is making it hopeless. You have to start somewhere and you have to grow, and growing isn't in a single piece. Growing is a lifetime occupation.
Yes.
So, well, but would you really wish it to be any other way? I think this is the same way with this. I mean, people say this is such a simple art form, and it is simple in some ways. But like most, it's not entirely simple. In fact, I think it's hard, which is why I always try and begin with the simplest.
Mm-hmm.
Then I go, okay, well, that didn't work. Let's try the next up the run. And see, when you get to too hard, I don't know. As I've lived through my needlepoint life, I used to like really hard. And now I think, does that really do that much more than just a simple this?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm never sure until I try it. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. I don't know. I just see it as an ongoing thing. I remember, you know, I had a friend who said, well, I went to college. She was saying this at home with the two of us. And she said, I've been to college. I'm educated. And my husband said to me afterwards, really? Is one ever educated? And I thought, isn't the same true with this? It's just a growth. I mean, it's an opportunity to grow artistically, creatively. So the most important thing is bring a bit of yourself to each piece you do. I think you get big. If I were talking to somebody who's stitching one of my queens, I would say, you know, I've put the studs up.
Mm-hmm.
I've put the basic framework. It's your job to fill in with what pleases you. And I don't say never, ever, ever very often, but I say it this once, and I've said it almost in the whole of the years I've taught. I've said never, ever, ever, ever stitch with a color you don't like. You'll never do decent work. If you don't like the color, go get another one you do like. And your work, that one factor will improve your work 1,000% right there. Only work in threads and colors that you love. I don't care who tells you to do what. You don't like it, throw it out. It's your piece. He or she is never going to know. And you don't have to please me. You have to please yourself. I sound like
most. Right, but most designers, in fact, have encouraged people to do the same thing. You know, I think people are afraid to deviate because they're afraid they're going to insult someone. And most of the people that we've spoken to have said exactly the opposite. They prefer that people interpret the piece their own way.
Well, it becomes your piece.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, why do you want it to be mine? So do we have any time left?
We got all the time in the world, Gan.
Are you going to edit this, Gary?
No way.
Okay, I want to tell you, I only, in the 25 plus years I taught, I only taught one ever great class. And it was really, it was the only great class I ever taught. When my father died, I made a morning sampler for him. That was about time and the passage of time. Had a clock, it had an hourglass on it, and it had four little scenes. And do you know, I don't know if you remember the name Jodi Adams. Did you ever know her?
No.
She was the queen of Callaway, and she was the queen of needlework in general for years and years and years. She sweet talked me into teaching that, which I didn't think it was appropriate, but she did, so I did. So I got to Callaway and I had a full class. And by that time it had passed to two other people who were running Callaway. And one of them came in and she pulled me out of class and she said, "What are you doing in there?" She said, "There's a line down at the Xerox machine." I believe in Xeroxing and Xeroxing and Xeroxing and tracing paper and all this sort of thing. So I had them doing that. She said, "They're down there. They're standing in line waiting their turn at the Xerox machine. And they're not only standing there, they're not only weeping, they are outright crying."
Oh, no.
She said, "Some of them sobbing." She said, "What are you doing?" And I said, all I did was say, this was my idea of my father's story. Don't make my sampler. Make it your own. Look internally and draw out some of the best things that you remember about your life, some of the touching moments. And that's what fits in those windows. Set the clock at the time that means something to you. Make the sky lighter or darker according to what you think. Make the waves a certain, whatever, I don't remember now, but it was that sort of thing. People, I thought, I'm going to be here drawing all for 4 days. It was a 4-day class, and I thought, all I'm going to be is somebody's electric pencil, you know, drawing what they tell me to draw. They didn't, they all drew. People told me they'd never drawn before. But you know, like the cave people drawing all the animals?
Mm-hmm.
There's this so deep inside us, these memories. They just came pouring out, and people would just sit there and cry and cry.
So what a great idea.
It was the thing that was so good about it was all of this came pouring out. And to a person in that class, they discovered they could draw, they could decide on things because of these images that were so close in their minds. And I thought, you know, that's what artists have always done. And I thought about the cave painters, you know, who I don't think we've ever done any better than that. And it's because the soul of it was there.
Yeah.
And that was true of this one. I never taught it again and never sold it again. But, you know, it was, and everybody, people had all kinds of things. Somebody who said, "I can't draw, you're going to have to do it for me." I said, "What do you want to draw?" I said, "Show me what it is you want me to do." And it was a religious symbol. And she sat down and drew it. She said, "Who would have ever thought I could do this?" But see, that was so entrenched in her mind.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes, you know what you said about looking at a painted canvas and saying, "Oh, it's just easier to follow the stitch guide." Do you know, look at it and figure out why, bring it home for a few days, look at it and think, why did I choose this? There's got to be a reason. It somehow spoke to me. What spoke to me? Was it something from my past? Is it something in my present? Does it say something of me? Whatever it says about me, I need to figure out how to incorporate it in that piece.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets the same effect as I got with that sampler of my father's.
Yeah.
And it becomes, I think that's what it's supposedly, I think that's what it's all about, is finding a piece of you that fits in it. So that just rote stitching, it's okay. You can do it 90% of the, you know, it's what I told a friend of mine one time who's going through bad times. "Christine, this is for your husband, okay?"
I
said, she said she's reading trash. I said, "It's okay to read trash. You can read trash some of the time, but you know, it doesn't mean anything. You have to read something that's really worthwhile to have it mean something. So you can stitch rotely. You can buy a piece and stitch it rotely. But every once in a while, as the spirit moves you, pick out something that speaks to you on another level and then bring yourself to it. And if you can follow the stitch guide, but where it doesn't quite suit you, then change it and watch what happens. I bet you'll do better work."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I have to loosen up. I have simply have to loosen up.
Okay, are we finished?
We can be finished if you'd like.
No, I want to tell a story, but I don't care if I tell. Oh, it is worse. let me tell the story, because I went to a watercolors painting class recently, and I had a great time. It was my husband's idea. He wanted to go. I thought, all I need to do is go paint for a day. So I went to this class, and the teacher went around the room. Watercolors is really hard to do. And I knew that I hadn't done watercolors since I was probably a teenager. So I went to the class, and the teacher was wonderful. And she went around the room asking each of us what we did in real life. And I said, I'm a needleworker. And she said, oh, we're going to have to work up to you, loosening you up. And, you know, I replied for once, and I said, no, you don't. I'm plenty loose. And here's why. When I was very young and impressionable, I took an art studio class. It was 5 hours. It was a summer class, lasted the whole summer, and it was 5 hours long. And you sat there. The instructor was a really good artist, but, you know, a different sort of human being. So normally in class in the morning, he arrived drunk, and then he would drink from being all out all night on Friday night. And he would drink buckets of coffee. And while he did in a day, now remember, this was good, probably 50 years ago. He would put up dual projectors and show there was nothing. He'd put slides, one old masters, one impressionist. They see there's nothing new. Get past it. And then when he was finally there, he taught by assigning projects. And so he assigned one and then two. And I don't remember which number this was. It was probably the second, third, or fourth. And he said, all right, go to the lumber yard and get child's blocks, 2x2, 16 blocks, 8 blocks, something like that. And he said, I want you to cut out newspaper clippings and then with rubber cement, paste them onto the blocks and then turn the blocks like children's blocks, right?
Yep.
You're following what I'm saying.
Got it. Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I went down to the lumber yard and I got the 8 blocks or the 12 blocks. I think it was 8, but we'll say it's 8. And I had pictures and I got all wonderful pictures and I took the rubber cement and I glued them on. I turned the blocks and I glued the next picture on and then I ran into trouble. I couldn't get the third picture to come up. So I went back to the lumber yard. I went back to the lumber yard, I think 3 or 4 or 5 times. And I was so frustrated. And then it dawned on me. That wasn't the point. The point was to make new images out of old ones. And I never again saw the world in the same way. And I think it literally changed the way I saw the world. And I thought, that's what it's all. I mean, it just dawned on me. I thought, I'm not supposed to be making the old images. I'm supposed to be seeing what happens with the new ones.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened. And I never, ever, ever, I mean, I was young and impressionable. I don't think it would happen today. I'm too cynical. But then I looked at it and it was like something just burst forth. And I thought, so that's the point of this. And it's been the point ever since. So I always look and think, you know, this is the way it is. Now, what would I do to it? And I think of each one of these portraits in the same way. What can I bring of me to it that says I'm making a statement with this? Anyway, now we're finished.
Now we're going to end. Okay, that's a good story to end on.
I hope you go edit this.
No, not happening.
Just put up the whole thing. How long has it been?
1 hour and 10 minutes, roughly. It's good.
Looks like to me. Well, maybe. All right.
Okay, Gan, thank you. Now, Queen Victoria Royal Bride, got to get a commercial in for you. Queen Victoria Royal Bride, available at GanRogers.com. Go there, look at the page. There's a page of history that goes with it. Then we have accessories. I was fascinated by these. We're going to go longer now because I got to hear Annette's accessories. You've got
Annette,
a journal.
Annette Navarro came into my life and she is wonderful because she makes unbelievable things. All those cards that are hers are all dimensional. It's, you know, from scrapbooking carding. And she makes them. So she and I hatched this idea. Do you know, have you ever thought, I stitched something I really like. I put a lot of time and effort into it. I should have kept track of my journey. She makes a journal so that you can keep track of it. It comes in an envelope. You glue the envelope to the back of the project when you get it framed. And then it tells whoever gets it, daughter, granddaughter. It tells what you want to say about a time when you were making it. I love the idea. I just love it.
Yes. I thought that was neat.
Journals. Then she decided one time she was going to make a zippered bag. And I thought, okay, you can make a zippered bag. So she always makes them in whatever she thinks matches my queen. And so this time she did cabbage roses, which, you know, goes with the spirit of the piece, I think, a bit. And so you keep your supplies in there. You don't lose them, because here's my hard and fast rule. I do not have endless supplies of these. You lose your supplies, you're on your own. You lose your beads. You lose your beads. You're on your own, because I probably don't have any more, and you have to be careful to keep them. Sometimes I don't. Sometimes I have extra packages. And then it depends. If you call me up and you say that I never sent them or something like that, then but if you call me up and you say, you know, I lost these. I just lost them. It's my fault. I say, okay, I might have a package for you. Tell me the truth.
So what was that? What were you telling me? How many thousands of beads did you put into bags? It was ridiculous.
To make these, somebody said, why are you stopping to make queens? Why is this the last queen? And I said, because I can't live through any more of it. This
too many.
Can't. It's too many. It's too many people who are too wired because they're worried it's not going to come out. And it's too much of a job for me to kit. So for this particular one, I cut up almost 10,000, I had almost 10,000 strands of silk and floss that I labeled. I cut it and counted it and put labels on it. I put just short of 28,000 beads in little baggies. Ooh. And I thought, you know what? I just can't do this again. Oh, I've got to cut back. So I say the queen will be on sale from the 10th of August till the 24th of August, or until I run out of kits. I have enough of them. I don't think I'll run out.
Okay. GayAnnRogers.com. Gayann, an absolute treat. Again, thank you so much for sharing.
Oh, thank you both.
Yep. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Thank you both for having me again.
Yep.
I hope we got it broad enough so it wasn't just about the queen.
We got it.
I think so. And I think the queen itself is spectacular. So.
Oh, thank you.
Yep.
I like that your husband liked it.
Yeah, he did, very much.
Because I was worried about that after our conversation.
It passed the test.
All right.
All right. Thanks for listening. Christine and I will be back on Wednesday.